It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, Calumet County is known as the supper club capital of the Midwest. A tourism official tells us why.
First, a tragic shooting in the small Wisconsin town of Mesa Mania has claimed two lives, including a 16-year-old girl. Dane County Sheriff Dave Mahoney said the shooting came at the hands of a 17-year-old boy allegedly angry over a breakup.
It's an extreme example of teen dating violence, an issue that doesn't always get the most attention but touches many lives. Statistics from anti-violence groups suggest that nearly one in three teens that have been in relationships have experienced domestic violence.
Here with us now to talk more about the issue of teen dating and relationship violence is Shannon Berry, Director of Domestic Abuse Intervention Services based in Madison. Shannon, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So this story out of Mesa Mania is fairly startling, mostly or in part because it involves teenagers. When we think about domestic violence, I think a lot of times we think of this as an adult problem. Is teenage domestic violence and partner violence something we overlook?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, adult domestic violence is often underreported, and I think when we add teen dating violence into the mix, that can be even more underreported crime. What we know from national statistics, though, is that women between the ages of 16 and 24 are actually at the greatest risk for intimate partner violence, including dating violence and sexual assault. So it is something that, unfortunately, is very common, and as you pointed out, Before I joined the conversation, we do know that about one in three teens have experienced some sort of violence in their relationship, and that includes physical violence as well as sexual violence.
Now, the teen years, confusing, emotionally charged time in a person's life, does that maybe lend itself to behavior like domestic violence, maybe part of the reason that it is so common, as you say?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there are some unique aspects of teen dating violence that differ somewhat from adult domestic violence. Certainly, you know, teenagers tend to perceive relationships as being much more significant, much more quickly. So, you know, for a teenager, a relationship can seem very serious within only a matter of a couple of weeks or months, whereas in, you know, adult relationships, we may take a little bit longer. I think, you know, maturity, we see relationships as being significant once that relationship has existed for a longer period of time. Additionally, I think, you know, for teens, they have some unique barriers in terms of achieving safety. Oftentimes, they are going to school with their abusive partner. It can be much more difficult to avoid that person. And I think teens are also less likely to reach out for assistance from adults and from their parents and other adults because I think they're at that developmental stage where they're really trying to assert their independence. So they may be less likely to reach out for assistance because they're trying to figure things out on their own. And then finally, you know, I think that there's a lot of legal protections that adults have access to that teens don't have access to, which can create some additional barriers. So all of those things kind of, you know, make it even more challenging for teens as they're sort of navigating these relationships. And in addition, you know, teens have a lot less experience with relationships and so may not recognize some of the warning signs that adults might recognize.
So you mentioned that teens don't always reach out to help, maybe don't know where to reach out to help. So if there's a teen in a situation like this listening or someone who knows one, where do you start? Where do they start?
Well, you know, there's every county in the state of Wisconsin has a domestic violence program that provides services. You know, here in Dane County, we have Domestic Abuse Intervention Services, or DAIS, and our helpline is available to anyone. It can be a teen who's seeking assistance or a concerned friend or family member, and that phone number is 608-251-4445. Additionally, there's a national hotline and a national website. The website is called loveisrespect.org, and that focuses specifically on teen dating violence. And they have a helpline as well, which is 1-800-1-866-331-9474. They also have a texting line, and all you have to do is text the word love is to number 22522, and they can provide 24-hour assistance to teens, because sometimes I think it can feel safer to teens to actually text for help, and so that's the national texting hotline.
Now, as you mentioned, we don't often talk about domestic violence among teens. When we do talk about it, are there things that you see people consistently get wrong, whether it's just a popular conversation or even in the media?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the things that we get wrong with teen victims are the same things we get wrong with adult victims, and it can be very well-meaning. You know, I think oftentimes people who are very concerned about someone in their life may say things like, you need to leave this person or I'm not going to help you anymore, and they take sort of a tough love approach. And that's not helpful for adult victims or for teen victims, because ultimately domestic violence and dating violence are all about power and control, and oftentimes the abuser has systematically isolated that victim from support networks. So by saying things that we think might be helpful, that could actually even further isolate the victim or feel like we're not safe people. So rather than saying, you have to leave this person or I'm not going to be your friend anymore, a better thing to say is, you know, I'm really concerned about the way your partner's treating you. You don't deserve to be treated that way, and I'm here to help you no matter how long it takes or whatever support you need. And I should also mention, too, for your listeners that, you know, the DAZE helpline, we get, as I said, we get a lot of phone calls from concerned friends and family members. It can be really difficult to support someone who's dealing with a situation like this. And so there are trained advocates available to help support people who are trying to support a victim in their life, who can help give them ideas about things that are helpful to say, things that are less helpful to say, as well as to just be a support person for them as they're navigating this with their loved one.
That's for parents and maybe friends of the victim of
Absolutely.
Domestic violence.
Mm-hmm.
Is there help out there for someone, maybe a parent, maybe a friend or a sibling who thinks they may know someone who's approaching the line where they're the perpetrator of domestic violence?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our helpline is certainly available to them as well. And there are batterers treatment providers throughout the state of Wisconsin. There's actually a network of certified batterers treatment providers. And those folks are the folks that we refer to. Oftentimes you may hear someone say, well, this person needs to go to anger management. And in reality, batterers are actually very much in control of their anger. They're very much in control of the violence that they're using. And that's why they tend to only perpetrate against one particular person, because they are in control of that anger. Somebody who's out of control of their anger tends to generalize their violence. So we only refer to certified batterers treatment providers. And the list of certified batterers treatment providers is available through the End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin website, which is wcadv.org, wcadv.org. They maintain that list of those folks who are trained and certified to provide batterers treatment.
Do you have thoughts on creating a culture among teens or even kids entering into the teen years where this kind of domestic violence is unacceptable? How do we get this maybe before we're even talking about a perpetrator and a victim?
Absolutely. That's a great question. So one of the strategies that we're using here in Dane County is a primary prevention program that we actually started years ago through funding from the Centers for Disease Control, and it's called the Men Encouraging Nonviolent Strengths Groups, or Men's Clubs. And we have these clubs throughout Dane County at different community centers and high schools. And really, it's to give young men an opportunity to have conversations with one another and with healthy male adult role models about what masculinity means to them, how to be a healthy man and a strong man without being a violent man. Because though we know statistically from national research that the majority of batterers tend to be men, we also know that the majority of men are not batterers. And I think that's a very important distinction, that most men do not choose to use violence in their relationships. So how can we help bolster those men as allies who can speak out, who can, intervene as bystanders when they see violence happening? We also have programming for young women that, you know, mirrors that programming that we are starting up again. It was very active for a while and sort of dissipated, but you're really giving young women an opportunity to have conversations about the many mixed messages they get from our culture and from mainstream media about what it means to be a woman and how those messages can sometimes contribute to vulnerability for potentially being in getting caught in these kinds of relationships, as well as, you know, the same thing, by the same token, young women not using violence in their relationships either. So I think there's a lot of great work that's happening, certainly upstream, and that primary prevention program has been really, I mean, we've been seeing some really outstanding results from the data of the kids who have been participating in those groups are much more likely to step up when they see violence happening in their communities. And are much more likely to intervene as bystanders.
Shannon, can you just leave us with a bit of advice if there's someone in this situation now? Okay, if you recover a little of the ground we already went over today.
Sure, absolutely. I think, you know, if anybody is even, you know, worried that the relationship that they're in might be, you know, that there might be some red flags for abuse, I would encourage them to call and reach out for help. Again, our helpline is 608-251-4445. And we, you know, we want to help people as early as possible so that they can think about, you know, if they're choosing to separate, that they can think about how to do that safely because we know that they're at greatest risk when trying to separate and from the relationship than at any other time. And we certainly saw that with this most recent incident. So even if, you know, somebody just has a question, it's always okay to call for help. And we're there.
Shannon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.
That's Shannon Berry. She's Director of Domestic Abuse Intervention Services.
Coming up, we'll talk to a tourism official from Calumet County about why that area is considered the supper club capital of the Midwest.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll learn about why Calumet County is considered the supper club capital of the Midwest.
First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. What is more Wisconsin than a brandy old-fashioned? Producer Aubrey Ralph went to uncover the history behind Wisconsin's love affair with brandy and this iconic cocktail.
If you ask people around the country, or in this case, Louisville, Kentucky, to name the first few things that come to mind when you say Wisconsin, you're likely to hear...
Lakes.
Isn't it cold there?
Cold weather and...
Beer?
Packers beer. Cheese.
I've never been to Wisconsin. I've never been there.
Okay, yes, it's cold here, and beer, football, and cheese are part of our lifeblood. But most outsiders miss something no Friday night fish fry would be complete without.
I was in Vegas for a business trip, and I decided to stop at the Riviera Bar, and I asked the bartender for a Corbel and Seven. And without even blinking, the bartender just looked at me and said, "How are things in Wisconsin?" Nobody orders brandy by brand except for people from Wisconsin. Welcome to Vegas.
Ah, brandy. Corbel made its first big splash in 1893 at the Chicago World's Fair, as you can hear in this fake archival recording.
Ladies and gentlemen, allow me to introduce you to Corbel.
Most of the time, our brandy ends up in old fashions, and I wanted to talk to a bartender about the evolution of our famous drink. Turns out, the perfect place was right here in Madison.
My name is Kirk Anotzik. I'm a professional bartender at the Old Fashioned. I somewhat tongue-in-cheek claim to be the guy who makes more old fashions than anybody else in the world.
And that might be close to the truth.
I counted them one year, and much to the chagrin of somebody from New York, I did it by counting the cherry stems. And in 2012, I made 11,706 old fashions. Our form of the old fashioned in Wisconsin probably came up the Mississippi, which was the 1800 superhighway. They fused two drinks together that were coming out of New Orleans at that time, a brandy smash and the Sazerac cocktail, which is functionally a brandy cocktail. Brandy went out of vogue all across the United States in 1870. And you saw all of the United States switch away from brandy to bourbon and rye, but Wisconsin didn't get the memo. Whether we were sitting on a big stash of brandy that nobody wanted, or we were addicted to cheap brandy and we just didn't care, but once Corbel was offered, everybody just jumped at it.
And now it's time to drink.
And so this is how we do them in Wisconsin. We've got fruit in the muddle and a soda-based mixer on top, and that's what I call the Mississippi River form. So you'll find something similar to this up and down the Mississippi, although Wisconsin's the only one that makes it with brandy. There's three steps to ordering an old-fashioned in Wisconsin. Step one, you would name a liquor, whiskey, bourbon, or brandy.
Brandy.
Step two, you would say old-fashioned. Step three, you would name a mixer, sweet, sour, press, soda, or water. And if you look at the way that's set up, as you run down your options of mixers, you're actually killing the sweetness, which tends to be more appealing to people from, say, Kentucky or, you know, the East Coast or something like that.
If you couldn't guess by how many old fashions he's made, Wisconsin drinks
a ridiculous amount of brandy, anywhere between 30 to 40% of the brandy in the United States every year. And that's one of the things that colors the state.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television. For more info, visit wisconsinlife.org.
A classic place to get a Wisconsin old-fashioned is a supper club. They're an iconic part of Wisconsin's culture, and you can find them all over the state.
The supper club, capital of the Midwest, apparently is here in Wisconsin in Calumet County. What makes this place the supper club capital? Dina Mooney is here to explain. She's the Calumet County planner. Dina, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So how did Calumet County become the supper club capital of the Midwest?
Well, I guess it's really unknown, but if anybody knows Calumet County, you know that we're a very rural county. But one theory is because the region was settled by men and women that worked hard in farm fields and needed a night out at the end of the week. And as more industrialization occurred in the area, people worked in the factories and looked forward to socializing with their family, friends, and neighbors. So with the, you know, end of the week celebration or the good night out, a lot of supper clubs have dotted our rural communities here in the area. Right now, Calumet County and the Calumet County area has inventoried 32 supper clubs.
32. That seems like a lot. I can't go county by county and give you other numbers, but does that seem like a lot of supper clubs to you?
It does. It seems like a significant number. And because of that, we went ahead and we filed a trademark with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office to actually title ourselves the Supper Club Capital of the Midwest.
Now, I think in a lot of places, it seems like maybe the day of the supper club has passed. Do you see a lot of your fellow residents of Calumet County still making a big point of hitting that supper club, maybe for that Friday meal?
Absolutely. In fact, we've seen a couple new supper clubs open up in the area. And even if some of our places aren't a traditional supper club that people would generally think of, we do have some more contemporary-style supper clubs that are popping up. And these restaurants are located still in our small rural communities. So throughout the county, you probably only need to travel 5-10 minutes to hit up a supper club.
Now, we were having a little debate in the office this morning about what was a steakhouse and what was a supper club. So how do you define and distinguish a supper club from other places?
Well, a supper club traditionally would serve a relish tray, bread, soups, also include a salad bar along with a hearty meal, and, of course, what you were previously talking about, the old-fashioned.
Yeah, we were arguing about what is the thing that a supper club has to have, and a couple of us came up with relish tray. Is it possible to be a supper club if you don't have the relish tray?
I don't know. I really don't know. It's kind of one of those expected treats every time you go to a supper club, or at least some type of appetizer there so you can enjoy your drink while you're socializing with your friends and family. You know, if it's garlic bread, carrot sticks, olives, even the olives that maybe come in your old-fashioned, you know, all of that is just part of the ambiance. And with some of these new style restaurants or supper clubs, you still get that, you know, this is something special.
Does it have to have sort of the low lighting and the little candles flickering on the table?
I think so. I think that's what most people expect when they go into a supper club.
Now, I asked earlier about the locals going to supper clubs. Do you see a lot of people coming from outside the county? You've got this critical mass of supper clubs there. Are we seeing supper club tourism there?
That I don't exactly know about, but because we are so rural and our population isn't really that big here in the county, they're coming from somewhere, right? So they're definitely coming from Sheboygan, Fond du Lac, Appleton, Oshkosh, Manitowoc, Green Bay, you know, all of those large cities don't necessarily have that small town, you know, with restaurant supper club that has these crazy amazing steaks and drinks and ambiance that you can only get out here in Calumet County.
Now, you guys actually created a map with all of the supper clubs in Calumet County on it once you became Supper Club Capital of the Midwest, and you got the fish fry listings on there. What does the map show us?
So on one side of the map, we do have a listing of all of the supper clubs. On the reverse side, we've also inventoried all of our establishments to get a fish fry. And one of the criteria for being listed on the map is that you really also have to have a bar that goes along with the restaurant. Our fish fry listing currently has 70 spots offering up a great fish fry. And with Lent starting next week, the fish fry is going to be even more popular on Fridays.
Well, Dina, thank you so much for being with us and talking supper clubs.
Thank you so much. And if people are interested in receiving our supper club map, please visit us at travelcalumet.com, and you can request your map on the Contact Us page.
Great. Well, thank you, Dina. That was Dina Mooney, Calumet County Planner. She was with us to explain why Calumet County is the supper club capital of the Midwest.
Coming up, does public radio sound too white? We talk with a professor and hip-hop artist who recently confronted this question when he produced his first radio piece. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. News is next here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll talk to a state lawmaker who wants technical colleges to be able to create charter high schools in Wisconsin.
First, Chenjerai Kumanyika is a professor and a hip-hop artist. When he recently voiced a radio piece with public radio in mind, he noticed something strange. He was suddenly speaking in a different voice, a voice that sounded like those we might hear on All Things Considered or This American Life, but it wasn't his own voice.
Kumanyika, who was participating in a transmedia production workshop, says he realized he instinctively changed his voice to match what he thought would be a more accepted NPR voice.
And the whole thing made him start to wonder, where are the diverse voices on public radio?
Chenjerai Kumanyika joins us now. He's assistant professor of popular culture in the communications department at Clemson University. He's also a hip-hop artist, and he recently produced his first public radio piece during a transom traveling workshop. Chenjerai, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for having me.
Doing good, thanks. Well, so to take us back to this piece, you're recording this piece, this radio piece that you put together, and you realize there's something weird about it as you read it through ahead of time, as you record it, because you can't really hear your own voice reading it in your head, and then when you record it, it doesn't sound right. Why not?
Yeah, it was kind of an instinctive thing where I just automatically switched. But as I was reading my script, it was a piece about a fisherman, I realized, what voice am I really speaking in right now? And so I had the concern, as I was practicing the piece, I realized I was hearing another voice in my head, kind of like, you know, it wasn't really like a Ira Glass or somebody like that, but it was kind of a more sort of standard public radio voice. And then when I actually played the piece back, you could tell that there was I had made like this shift in how I was speaking.
You do say that a lot of people do what is called code switching, which could be one way of looking at what happened to you. You go from maybe talking one way in one setting with a specific group of people to talking another way in another setting. Do you think that code switching is what was going on?
I think that it was. You know, you learn that there's a certain way of speaking that's standard. And you kind of internalize those standards. And everybody, I think, has to code switch a little bit. I don't think anyone is exactly the way they are, you know, when they're at work in certain professional contexts. But I do think that there's ways in which certain groups have to make more of a shift and sort of alter their voices more. And I can't say, you know, for a particular person that they're necessarily doing it down to the individual. But I know that if we listen to our public radio landscape, I mean, you know, the range of voices is, you know, not reflective of what the demographics of the United States actually are.
looking back, you know, why did you feel like you had to change your natural way of speaking, the way that felt like it was Chenjerai?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that I don't hear a lot of examples on public radio. And I'm a public radio fan, right? Like, I love to listen to public radio. I listen to it all the time. So it's not like I was coming, you know, kind of just looking for something to hate on or, you know, this kind of thing. But, you know, I listen to these shows, and sometimes in the back of my mind, I do think about it. I say, wow, this is just a moment where it's just like not, this what's being presented here is not targeting people who sound like the way I sound or certain groups. And sometimes it comes to fruition when I try to share it with certain people. Like, I'll hear a really exciting episode of, you know, of whatever, whichever show it is, you know, shoot. You know, I don't know that there's a whole, for me, like a whole lot of exciting episodes of Prairie Home Companion, but it could be something like that. You know, you know, that's not necessarily my genre, but, you know, it could be any of the shows on there, and I'll like play it for someone, and I can see if I'm talking to certain, you know, certain of my friends, that there's just a reaction to what they're hearing. Like, it sounds kind of like, this whole cultural reference point, this is not for me.
Yeah, you talked to a guy, a friend of yours, who's a hip-hop artist, I think, among other things, and he calls it sort of, I'm paraphrasing here, but sort of a white guy who's been sipping warm coffee in a Barnes & Noble voice.
Right, A.D. Carson, the now famous phrase, warm coffee voices, you know? And I mean, I think that's a little bit of a generalization. I don't think that's really 100% accurate, but the thing that I think we have to deal with is we all know what he's talking about. You know, if you listen to public radio, you know what he means by that. I mean, and yeah, I mean, it's an obstacle. I've struggled to get AD. You know, we're close. And I mean, he's a doctoral student. He's a novelist, someone who definitely can appreciate the kind of content in theory that public radio would offer. But he kind of feels like it's not really, as he says, it's a particular kind of thing going on for him that's not really targeted for him.
Well, I want to play some examples of what we're talking about here. The first thing I'm going to play is what you recorded the first time when you felt as though you had to sound a particular way that was most in keeping of what NPR sounds like. Here it is.
John Towsky can't shake the moment he lost a 50-pound white sea bass.
Well, of course, you know, the ones that got away stay with you for a long time.
It was before sunrise and he was alone.
You don't have any help. You don't have an extra guy to put the gaff in the fish. You've got to kind of do it all yourself, which is the ultimate challenge.
And then the moment every fisherman waits for.
Yeah, I had a nice fish, a nice white sea bass.
And now we're going to listen back to back here to the second take you did. This is after you became aware of what you were doing and some of the context behind it. And you tried to revoice it in an authentic voice. Here it is.
John Towsky can't shake the moment he lost a 50-pound white sea bass.
Well, of course, you know, the ones that got away stay with you for a long time.
It was before sunrise and he was alone.
You don't have any help. You don't have an extra guy to put the gaff in the fish. You've got to kind of do it all yourself, which is the ultimate challenge.
And then the moment every fisherman waits for.
Yeah, I had a nice fish, a nice white sea bass.
And there it is, a second take. What do you hear in that second take now?
Well, I got to say, you know, Veronica, the first thing I really hear is John Towsky has the most interesting voice, I think. His voice, I mean, his voice is the one we should say, this rich, gravelly voice where you're like, oh, my God, I just, you know, really like listening to him talk. But, yeah, I just hear that my voice kind of went up in pitch a little bit. And, you know, I didn't sound on the first take the way I sound now talking to you. You know, it's like the pitch and just I kind of describe it. I say I kind of squared off all the rounded corners of the way I speak. And so, yeah, you know, I feel more comfortable listening to the second take.
So when there is a voice that seems to be the dominant voice, the way people more or less sound on public radio, what do you think that does to the listeners, to people like your friend, A.D. Carson?
Yeah, I think it to some extent, it alienates people. It sends a subtle message that this is not for you. I also think that there's really important information encoded in different people's styles of speech. You know, when you hear people speak in a way that's not modified completely and not translated. And so, you know, I know that there's some people listening who are just like, well, you have to have standards, and there's a reason why we have standards and something called professional. professionalism, you know. But for me, it's like what I think we have to be willing to do is if we're really serious about diversity, we have to look at the way that different types of racial hierarchies and things hide, and also gender, regional hierarchies, right? Class hierarchies. It's not all about race, but the way those things hide in a term like standard. Because for me, standard and professional has something to do with who gets to be comfortable.
Yeah, I got to say, this piece really made me think, because that public radio voice that you're talking about, you know, that your friend calls the coffee voice, that can be constraining for a lot of people. I'm going to use myself as an example. There are things about my economic history, my racial background, that you can't hear in my voice, probably because I trained them away to sound more like a specific kind of voice, maybe more like the one that you're talking about. So how does public radio let go of its perceptions and allow for all different kinds of voices?
No, it's such a good question. And I think that, you know, I'm hoping, and I'm starting to see this a little bit, this conversation expand into different groups. I want to understand. I kind of gave a little bit about my story, right? But I want to hear more about how other people fit in other identity categories from different regions, women, people of other kind of gender identities. What are their experiences, and to really see this fully come forth? Because I think a lot of people don't understand the journey and how much effort it can take, how difficult it can be. You know, I've heard stories. Some people have, you know, emailed me anonymously or, you know, in pride and confidence talking about how they've been coached in different ways and told that their way of speaking wasn't correct. So I'd like to get those stories on the table, you know.
And how do we do that? How do we get those stories on the table?
Well, one is, I think, you know, I think there's structural aspects of it. And this is kind of, you know, I know this probably sounds a little bit professorly and not, you know, people don't want to hear it. But one element of it has to operate at the structural level, where you have to have people in power who are willing to create a context where that happens. Because if all the pressure is on the hosts, right, then and on the people who are speaking themselves, the sort of amateur podcast person or the amateur radio person, that's a tricky spot to be in. You know, if you have a job and have an opportunity, it's already a rough business. And then someone is telling you you're not speaking correctly, you're probably going to go along with that. So you need people in power who are willing to make that change. I think also we need to open up this conversation about professionalism and maybe push the expectations of the audience a little bit more. You know, like, we shouldn't be so quick to rush to say, well, someone is just unprofessional or they haven't properly learned the English language. I mean, I travel in, you know, the UK a lot for my hip hop group, because we had actually a gold album in the UK. And, you know, no one can talk to me about standard English once I travel to different parts of the UK. Because I'm like, well, which one is the standard English? The one they speak in Wales, or the one they speak, you know, the Cockney? I mean, which right. one, you know?
It's a whole other topic there to talk about. Well, we're talking about the voice and the sound of public radio right now, and we'd like to hear your voice on this. Is public radio sound too, to use the word, white, too homogenous? Which voices are currently missing from the public radio landscape, and what do we need to do to include them? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the voice of public radio, the standard professional voice, and asking maybe if it's too standard, too white, too middle to upper class. Do you think public radio needs more diverse voices, diverse sounds of voices? What's currently missing, and what can stations do to attract those voices and maybe attract more diverse listeners along the way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Chenyurai Kumanyika stays with us. He's assistant professor of popular culture in the communications department at Clemson University, and he's also a hip-hop artist. And I want to ask you, Chenjurai, as the American population gets more and more diverse, would you say that public radio's future depends on the ability to change, to embrace more voices of all types?
Absolutely. I mean, I think if we're going to be serious about what we mean when we say public, we have to ask the question, who really is the public, right? I mean, you know, somewhere like California, you know, you have like a huge Latino population that is actually, you know, going to be larger than in some places than the white population. So I think, yeah, I think it really does. And particularly if we're interested also in issues of social justice, if we want to understand how different groups are affected, issues that affect different groups. And that to me is what's so wonderful and about public radio, why I love it, because you get such a more, you know, rich kind of coverage than what you get in other certain other kinds of media.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Kelly with us in Appleton. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, Kelly.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
What do you think?
Well, I have a little bit of experience on both sides of that. I was military for 20 years, and you tend to travel with the military every 4 years. So I started out in Mississippi, in Gulfport, but then you're transferred to Hawaii and California and to Japan. And I noticed that even now I live in Wisconsin and I'm from Chicago. When I'm up here, it's A or A or you guys, and then you go to Mississippi and it's y'all, and you go to Hawaii and Mahalo. You just kind of go back and forth. Well, growing up, I grew up in Chicago in a multiracial area, and we had Sicilians on one side that straight from Sicily. My mom and dad were from England and Ireland, and we were having a discussion, a bunch of little 9-year-olds sitting around talking about our parents and us, and the little girl who was Italian was saying, well, your mom doesn't speak English. She's from England. She speaks English. And you're like, okay, you just said the same thing. And so we turned it around and we says, well, you're from America. What do you speak? And she says, I speak American.
Right.
And
so
kind
lots
of with
of...
the slang going back, you know, the English accent, that never goes away. She's going to be 85 here shortly, and everybody in Wisconsin picks up on it, but I don't hear it because of my ear. I'm used to it.
And right. Well, thank you so much for your thoughts, Kelly. Lots of different ways to interpret this, as you were saying. What do you think about embracing, you know, regionalisms and things like that? I know that there's a sort of a Midwest sound that people aspire to, especially when they want to do broadcast news, but should we just be embracing of everything?
Yeah, I mean, to me, I think, you know, you can't really get the flavor of this country without going into those regional ways of speaking. There's so much that you learn from that. I'm in South Carolina, where there's all these different, you know, beautiful kinds of Southern accents. And sometimes your ear has to reach a little bit when certain people are speaking, you know. And that, the question is, are we willing to do that, you know, to get out of our comfort zone? Because I think you can learn so much. And, you know, the way, you know, the mid, different types of Midwestern accents as well. So, yeah, I think you can't really understand who the public is and who the country is without getting into those regionalisms a little bit.
Kelly, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go next to Kathleen in Madison. Hi, Kathleen.
Hello. I have kind of the opposite experience as a listener. A lot of times I'll have WHA radio on for background, and they're still telling how many different accents I hear in one day, and to the point where sometimes I'm pick up almost foreign-sounding speech. And then another thing that I wanted to bring up is a lot of times I hesitate to call in radio stations in general because I have autistic speech. I have high-functioning autism, and especially as I get older, I hesitate to call in because it takes me longer to say things and people don't have patience. And so those are two things.
Well, thank you so much, Kathleen. And I'm very glad that you called in today for this discussion. And Chenjerai, she brought up a couple different things. She hears a lot, she says, of different accents on public radio. And she, on the other hand, also feels like she is a little scared to use her natural voice. What do you say about those two things?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for calling. I'm really glad you called in. And yeah, I mean, the nature of public radio is that depending on where you are, the particular blend of shows and accents that you might hear might be a little bit different. Everybody's not hearing the same thing. There's certain some of the shows that are nationally syndicated you are. But now this other point that you raise, I think that's really important. I mean, you know, I remember, you know, there's a quote in an article about disability that says, you know, what we think of as disability really reflects the priorities of a society, and rather than always something about the physical state of people or the conditions people have. Are we patient enough to listen to different paces of speech? People have to speak different ways. I mean, I think that, you know, probably some of these standards might actually exclude people who have to speak different ways because of their the way their bodies and their minds work. So I think that's so important, and I hope we can expand and talk more about that.
I'm sorry to say we're out of time, but I'm so glad you could come on and talk about it today, Chenjerai.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, and I really appreciate you all taking up this conversation.
We've been speaking with Chenjerai Kumanyika, Assistant Professor of Popular Culture in the Communications Department at Clemson University, and he's also a hip-hop artist. You can read more about this story on NPR's Code Switch blog or follow the Twitter hashtag PubRadioVoice.